What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. Delighted to have you with us on this Wednesday afternoon. This is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, something that just doesn't sit right with you, you don't get it. Does the Catholic Church actually teach that? Well, let's talk about it. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response, and then once you get it, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can always send us an email 24/7. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. All right, Pedro Quiles, our producer, Matt Kabinski on the phones, Ace McKay handling social media for us, and we welcome all of you listening to us today on YouTube and Facebook. We're streaming on both those platforms right now. I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I am well. How are you, sir?
You know I'm doing decent. Thank you.
You're a little on the puny side today.
I feel a little bit puny today, but we'll pull through.
You are a trooper. I am very impressed with that. If I could count up the number of sick days you've taken in the last 11 years, I don't think it would fill one hand.
Probably not, actually. I've had a few.
You're a good man. We're going to lead off with this question that came in last night on the EWTN listener comment line.
Hi, this is Doug in Aloha, Oregon, and a follow-up to the call from the on Tuesday, November 4th, from a woman who was distributing communion, and a non-Catholic approached her. I'm a cradle Catholic, and I have asked family and friends over the years if they believe in the real presence. They are regular communicants, and I received three different answers. Yes, when I say God bless you. Not really, but I pray that the Holy Spirit will change my heart. And I said, I'll pray for you. And no, but going to communion is the Catholic thing to do. And I said I'll pray for you. But should I have challenged those other two to say, well, if you don't believe, you shouldn't go to communion? What do you think? Thanks, Dr. Anders. Bye bye.
Okay, thanks, Doug. I really appreciate the question. So it was unclear to me from the call whether Doug actually serves as an extraordinary minister or not.
I believe he does.
Okay. Because I think, you know, if you're not even distributing communion, the question takes on a completely different tone to it. But so here's my take on that. Obviously, the yes people, you know, that's not an issue. Now, I will say, let me back up, sort of meta answer here.
Okay.
Whether or not a person believes in the real presence is important for one's profitable communion. It is not the only criteria, right? And so, sometimes non-Catholics will approach and say, well, you know, I believe in the real presence. Why can't I receive communion? And I've known Catholics who get stumped by that because they think, well, the reason you can't receive is you don't believe in the real presence. It's much more than that, right? Because a Catholic who believes in the real presence can be otherwise ill-disposed to receive communion. So believing in the real presence is necessary, but not sufficient. Not sufficient. You have to be in the state of grace in communion with the church to receive communion in the Catholic Church, which would include communion and all that the church teaches to be revealed by God, including the doctrine of the real presence. So we throw that out there first of all. But with respect to the real presence issue, yes, obviously that poses no difficulty. To the person who says not really, but I'm praying about it, or I'm praying that God will change my heart. With that person, I personally would stop and go, well, hang on a second here, right? Because you might have a misunderstanding about what the nature of faith entails, right? If you think that faith entails having a kind of subjective certainty, you know, based on evidence that's tangible and, you know, you can kind of sense the reality of the thing in the same way that, you know, that I know that, you know, eggs are eggs, right? If that's your conception of faith, like, well, I just can't see how it can be the real presence of Christ, and, you know, it doesn't make sense to me, and it sure looks like bread, it sure smells like wine, you know, I don't know, man. that may not fall short of Catholic faith, right? Mm. Because what the church says about faith is not knowledge. Knowledge, there's a difference between faith and knowledge. I mean, I know that there's a coffee cup sitting on my table right now. I know because it's evident. It's evident. And if Tom came by and swiped it off and said, Anders, no more coffee. You've had enough. Well, it would be evident to me that it wasn't there then. You know, knowledge automatically updates.
Sure.
In the presence of a defeater, right? Faith is not like that. Faith is not knowledge. Faith is something that we accept based on authority because there are spiritually pragmatic reasons to do so. I'm taking the word of Christ or the word of the church. Though I don't know these things to be true, I choose to believe that they're true. I choose to align my life, to frame my reality from the point of view that I will proceed in life as if these things are true that I cannot know to be true, but I'm gonna put my will to work, you know, to order my life accordingly, right? But I might feel very differently. I might feel very differently. A person might feel that God never answers their prayers. All the evidence may suggest that God never answers their prayers. And that individual could still say, but by golly, I'm going to pray. I don't feel like anything's going to happen. But I'm going to pray anyway because that's a Catholic thing to do. That was one of the criteria you threw out, that the Catholic thing to do. And so someone who said, you know, I'm praying that God will change my heart, are they praying for a change of heart or are they praying for a change of sentiment?
Ah.
Because if they've said, you know, I know this is what the church teaches and I want to be with the church, but common expression today, I'm not feeling it. You know, I want to be with the church, but I'm not feeling it. Well, that may not be a lack of faith. That may just be a misunderstanding of what faith entails, right? And if you say, you know, God has revealed it, the church has taught it, I acquiesce to the authority of the church, but I'm not feeling it, I'd say you have faith. I'd say that counts as faith, right? If you say, look, I refuse to accept it, I'm not going to order my life accordingly.
Yeah.
Well, that's unbelief, okay? To the person that says no, but going to communion is a Catholic thing to do, that's kind of like the guy who gets in the car without gasoline and starts rolling down the hill away from his house because he says, you know, driving my car is a common thing to do, but there's no gas in the car. Like, you're going to peter out. You're not going anywhere,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's not true. Going to communion is a Catholic thing to do when you're properly disposed and believe in the teaching of the church.
Sure.
Otherwise, you're not doing yourself any good. You're not helping yourself by going to communion if you're not aligned with the church.
Doug, thanks so much for your call to our EWTN listener comment line. And hey, we're taking your live calls right now at 833-288-EWTN for Call to Communion. It's Called a Communion with Dr. David Anders in progress here on this Wednesday afternoon on EWTN. Calls are coming in right now at 833-288-EWTN. There is room for you. 833-288-3986 or text the letters EWTN to 58177. Let's give a little shout out here to National Vocation Awareness Week. It's going on right now. It's a week-long celebration dedicated to promoting vocations to the priesthood, diaconate, and consecrated life through prayer and education, and to renew our prayers and support for those who are considering one of these vocations. So a big salute to all of you who are in this. It's National Vocation Awareness Week going on right now. We're going to get to the phones in just a moment. Interesting question that we received yesterday from Lori, who says, hey, Dr. Anders, I have a question about the neo-catechumenal way. Our bishop was formed in their teachings. However, it's really affecting our community and dividing us. Do you have any recommendations?
Wow, that's a great question. So, you know, this is something that the popes have actually spoken to. They all acknowledge the legitimacy of the neo-catechumenal way.
Okay.
They have also all cautioned against the possibility that lay movements in the church, by their very nature, can be divisive. It's kind of the nature of such movements. And the way it shakes out is that, and it's not hard if you get into a thing. And this is not a criticism of the neo-catechumenal way. This is about human nature, right?
Sure, sure.
If you are, as it were, a generic Catholic, and then you become a Catholic with an adjective.
Okay.
You know, I am a blank Catholic. I am a charismatic Catholic. I am a traditionalist Catholic. I am a fill-in-the-blank Catholic. You attach your adjective, your qualifier to Catholic.
Uh-huh.
Then the risk is that you come to think of your, you know, your adjectival group as, well, you know, we're the serious Catholics, or we're the real Catholics, or we're the Catholics with a difference, or we're, the, you know, whatever. And of course, St. Peter tells us that through the promises of Christ, not our ideological movement, but through the promises of Christ, we have, and I quote, all we need for life and godliness. All we need for life and godliness. Now, this is not a new problem in church history. So, you know, Augustine wrote a book on the work of monks and another one on the good of marriage. And, you know, these are vocations within the church. And one of the dangers that he singles out, particularly with the monastic vocation, is he says, you know, don't think you're all kinds of hot stuff because you're a monk. You know, just because you're a monk doesn't make you automatically holy, you know. And Thomas Merton once remarked, and I forgot where I read this in Merton's Corpus, but that was a great quote. He said, the first thing a monk needs to do is to learn that he's not a monk. That's not a Zen koan. What he means is, like, your identity is in Christ. The point of the monastic vocation is not to be like, ho, 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 I'm a monk. The point is to forget yourself, right? To become less self-important, right? Not to think less of yourself, but to think of yourself, you know, less often. Right?
He must,
you know,
increase.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so anytime you attach some qualifier to your Catholic identity, it should further the aims of your sanctification, which means greater humility, greater charity, you know, greater love for others, greater, you know, taking the lowest place, not the highest place at the table. But that human temptation that Christ preached about constantly to make whatever your thing is the thing and to look down upon your neighbors does have the tendency to be divisive. So, you know, what can you do about it in your diocese? Well, you know, as an individual, probably precious little except to live your own vocation to Catholic holiness as generously and humbly as possible.
Sure.
And when people come by and they say, you know, I've got this really great, wonderful devotional thing, you go, well, isn't that nice? Isn't that good for you? You know? And, you know, we got a call on this show one time, and I thought there was a little bit of a polemical edge in the caller's voice, and it was pressing on me a question like, well, I do X, Y, and Z, Dr. Anderson. What do you think of that? And I remember saying, well, quite literally, and not a hint of sarcasm, good for you. Good for you. Like, if that's the thing in the Catholic tradition that brings you to holiness, good for you. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that's the thing that's going to bring everyone in the Catholic Church to holiness. The thing that's going to bring us to holiness is Christ and our conformity to his likeness and image. Now, you can approach that from different angles,
sure.
But at the end of the day, it's going to be Christ who brings you to holiness, not your adjective.
Lori, thanks so much for your question. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Jay. Jay is in Vancouver, Washington, listening on the great Modern Day Radio. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for the call. Okay, I'll try to make this clear because I've called only two times before, but I guess I didn't express the question right. So I got the wrong answers both times. But I called back at anyway, all right, here we go. I read the Bible every day, and I read the Old Testament and New Testament. Here's what happens. And again, I'm talking about the Old Testament. Maybe these are just words. I hope I say this question right. In the early books, Exodus and Numbers, it kind of distracts my reading, but and it says constantly, the Lord your God, the Lord your God, the Lord, like over and over. And I'm like, okay. And then later, like right now, I'm reading Zechariah, and it says, the oracle of God, the Lord of hosts. Why does that change? That's my only question. That doesn't take away from me reading or getting the point that it's making, but it just, it sidetracks me. It's like a rock in my shoe. I'm still going to get to my destination, but it's kind of like, it just stumbles my reading. So I just want to know if there was any significance to it or if it's just a change of words.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. Let me say, first of all, that I am so sorry that this is the third time you've had to call to get your question through my dumb, thick skull and that I failed to answer your question adequately the first two times. I'm really very sorry about that because my objective here is to help people out with their issues and not to obscure things. So I really am sorry about that, and I hope that I can do a better job now. Now, if I understand your question, the difficulty you're having is that there are different titles or different forms of address used with respect to God in the Old Testament, and they're not consistent, and that throws you off. Do I understand the question correctly this time?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. I didn't know if it was significant or not, because I don't want to beat myself up because they use the... please.
Yeah, okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. I think I understand now. So most biblical scholars believe that the texts of the Old Testament were, they weren't penned by a single author, and even the individual books were not penned by a single author, but they represent probably oral traditions that came before the texts, and from diverse places within the Holy Land. And so in particular, you find different traditions in the northern kingdom of Israel, what would become Samaria, than you do in the southern kingdom. And you find differences, of course, over the ages too, right? So religion evolves, and you find some things in earlier strata of the tradition that differs from later strata of the tradition.
Okay.
And to the best of our ability to ascertain, the text of the Bible that we have now is the result of a later editorial process where earlier texts and oral traditions were woven together and sometimes kept, with a certain degree of integrity. And so you can find places in the text where, within the same narrative, there'll be contradictions in the text, like a paragraph apart. And it almost really feels like someone took, two different accounts of the same story that weren't consistent and then just copied and pasted them together without resolving the inconsistencies. Those are the kind of reasons why scholars think, one of the reasons they think that the Bible is a composite work. Right, because there are areas where it doesn't seem to flow smoothly, as if it were the product of a single pen, right? And titles of the deity is the first inconsistency that critical scholars noticed, principally in the 19th century, when they began to hypothesize about the possibility of different documents standing underneath the text of the Old Testament. It's called the documentary hypothesis. And they weren't the titles specifically that you named, but in the Genesis account, for example, you find God referred to by the name Yahweh, YHWH, and also by Elohim. And there seems to be a pattern. The kinds of stories that fall under the one don't fall under the other. And so the earliest hypothesis was, maybe there was a tradition that we'll call the Yahwist tradition, Y, or J, and another one we'll call the Elohist tradition, or E. And so J and E were the first earliest two hypothesized sources for the text of the Old Testament, right? So there's a lot of that going on, and obviously it would be pedantic to try to break down all of those differences and identify different sources, but that's one reason why there are different titles. Another reason is that even within a single text, like say the Psalms, Hebrew poetry works sometimes it works all the time by setting up parallelisms. The author will say something one way and then turn right around and say the same thing another way with a slight variation on the language. And they didn't go so much in for rhyme scheme when they wrote poetry, but they loved to throw in those literary parallelisms. And, I know when I was studying expository writing and prose style years ago, that's one of the first things you learn is, yeah, don't use the same word over and over and over again in the same paragraph. It looks kind of drags. So there's also some of that element going on. Now, is there any theological significance to it for us? And what the Catholic Church says is that, the literal sense of the text, that's the kind of sense that's discovered by the sort of scholarship that I'm talking about, right? You get under the sources and you try to do the exegesis and you look at the Greek and the Hebrew and you figure all that kind of stuff out. That's the literal sense. But we can always draw an application at the spiritual sense. Can I apply this to my life in some way that makes it more edifying? And I could reasonably see that a person could engage in a meditation on the names of God and focus in on their differences as a way of magnifying their sense of God's majesty. In fact, there is an early Christian writer named Dionysius the Areopagite who has a whole treatise called On the Divine Names. And it's not these names, but, he looks at the variety of the ways that the church has named God as an exercise that could be intrinsically edifying.
But does it make a difference?
So when you talk about making a difference, a lot of what the work of devotion is about is trying to evoke in me an emotional response that will motivate my life of virtue, right?
Okay.
So, you know, when I do any kind of engagement with the text of Scripture, ultimately it's in the hopes that I can, something in there will strike a chord with me and motivate me to live a better life.
Okay. Is that helpful for you, Jay?
Yeah, that was really good. And like I said, I still got the point of what I was reading.
Yeah.
But it was just bugging me, like, why did they change the name? It's really irrelevant, but it was kind of like a rock in my shoe. I'm still getting my destination. I get the point. But the questions hovering around the back of my head, and you explained it perfectly. Different times, different artists, different
sure.
writers, and
sure.
they changed the words. Perfect. Thank you. I can move on with my life and keep on reading.
Good well, man.
Thank you, and I really appreciate your persistence. And let this be a lesson to me and to listeners. Sometimes you have to ask Anders the same question three times before he gets it. Right. So please call back if I don't get it right the first time.
Love that. Hey, Jay, thanks so much for your call from Vancouver. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Or text the letters EWTN to 58177. Here is Rebecca now. Rebecca is in Post Falls, Idaho, listening on the EWTN app. Hey there, Rebecca. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I have a quick question. Do Catholics believe that you can accomplish perfection here on earth? And if so, where in the Bible does it say that?
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate the question. So Christ himself, in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, admonishes us to be perfect as the Father in heaven is perfect. And you know, the way Catholics look at demands in Scripture, divine commands, is that God doesn't command things that are intrinsically impossible. It would be absurd to command something that was intrinsically impossible. You know, imagine if I demanded that my 16-year-old son, have mastered Mandarin by tomorrow, right? That would make me a very unreasonable person. You know?
A little, yeah.
It's not possible, right? I'm not going to ask him to do that. And so Christ demands the thing, right? But we can dig a little bit further in. And Christ himself and St. Paul in the epistles teach that the fulfillment of the law is charity.
Okay.
Romans 13:8 says love is the fulfillment of the law, right? And Christ, when he's asked about the greatest commandments, you know, to love God above all things, love your neighbor as yourself, everything else is kind of commentary on that, right? So then we have to ask the question, well, is it possible for a Christian to experience love? And I don't mean as the object being loved, but experience in the sense of in a participatory way. Can I love with the love that God, wherewith God loves me? Can I love back as God has loved me? Well, that's absolutely the case, because again, the Book of Romans chapter 5 says that the love of God is poured into our hearts. The love of God is poured into our hearts. Christ says if we want to be our disciples, we have to imitate him, take up our cross, and follow him. St. Paul says we can have the mind of Jesus. He says, have this mind in you that was in Christ Jesus.
Yeah.
He tells us that we can offer our bodies as living sacrifices, and thereby to renew our minds after the pattern of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
St. Peter says that we can become participants in the divine nature. That's 2 Peter chapter 1. And then St. John in his epistles says that if anyone claims to abide in Christ, he must walk as Jesus walked, which is to say in charity. And St. Paul, in a wonderful passage in 1 Corinthians 13, speaks about these three main, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love, which he clearly holds out to be the norm and the rule for Christian life.
Rebecca, thanks so much for your call from Idaho. In a moment, we'll get to Anthony in Arizona. Hopefully, your call as well. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion. Still time for your phone call to EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. A couple lines open for you, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. 888-298-3986. Hey, congratulations to another EWTN radio partner, KVSG 107.1 FM, serving Twisp, Washington. What a great name, Twisp, Washington, celebrating 10 years with us this week. Congratulations to Father Pedro Bautista Peraza and his great team there at St. Genevieve Catholic Parish from your friends here at EWTN. Let's go to Arizona and talk with Anthony right now, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Hello, Anthony. What's on your mind today, sir?
Yeah, thank you. I just was interested, a lot of discussion. If Christ was here today, how do you differentiate between the religion Judaism and Zionism and the apartheid and how it was created and is there that all related? Is any relationship for us to understand? I know there's a Catholic position, obviously, but I see the politicians here in the United States are just not one. But for the last 50 years, besides a political point here, but more of a religious, from God's perspective, and that the Zionism and Judaism, one is religion, one is a national movement. How does it fit in the equation of the biblical sense, Old Testament, New Testament?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate the question. So let's define our terms here. Judaism is a world religion whose origins are in ancient Judea, hence the term Jew comes from the word Judah. Uh-huh. A Jew is one who is from Judah.
Okay.
And it obviously draws on the heritage of the Hebrew Bible, although that's not its exclusive source, and the institution of the synagogue as it evolved in the exilic world after the conquest of Babylon, Babylon's conquest of Jerusalem, and the inhabitants, when they were scattered around, they found ways to continue to maintain their religious identity in the diaspora, and the synagogue is one of those traditions, as well as the development of the rabbinate, which was not something that you found in biblical times. It's authoritative teachers that would interpret the law of Moses, and so the modern institution of Judaism, if you think about the people maybe you know in your neighborhood that practice Judaism, they go to a synagogue, they have a rabbi, and to some extent, they have a connection to Jewish traditions that are recorded in a sacred text called the Talmud, which is post-biblical writing, most of which came out of Babylon. And beyond that, there are things we could point to, but there are also a lot of differences among Jews or those who practice that religion called Judaism. Now, Zionism is something different. Zionism is a political movement that emerged in the 19th century. And in fact, its origins were secular and not explicitly religious or theologically motivated. And the motive force in Zionism was the idea that Jewish people throughout the world should have a homeland, a political homeland, where they could be free of persecution, because the history of Jews throughout the world had been, a pretty pitiable one. They were always a minority wherever they went, and, minorities are not always treated well and sometimes treated quite horribly. And of course, after the horrors of the 20th century and Nazism and so forth, the drive to realize that dream of a political homeland for the Jews became even more poignant. It was not a foregone conclusion in the early days of Zionism that political homeland had to be in the heartland of what was once ancient Judah. And in fact, there were other alternatives that were noised about by people. But because of the connection to the land and to the monarchy and to the temple and all that, of course, ultimately the land of Israel, what would become modern Israel, won out. And because of the happenstance of the First World War and the British taking control of the Holy Land after the Ottoman Empire, created a kind of an opening there for political Zionism to take hold. And so waves of Jewish migrants began to move to the Holy Land and to set up settlements. And eventually to agitate for independence, and of course after the Second World War and the horrors of the Holocaust, the world got on board with that plan and essentially agreed to the to the creation of the modern state of Israel. Now, I mentioned that early Zionists were not necessarily religious or theological in their motivations. There is clearly such a thing as religious or theological Zionism, and that is the belief that because of Judaism's historic connections to the land of Judah, that that they somehow have a divine right to the land, and there's some sort of, or alternately, maybe some sort of profound eschatological purpose in their moving to the Holy Land. There are Jewish Zionists that take that point of view. There is such a thing as Christian Zionism. The Catholic Church does not subscribe to Christian Zionism, but there are many Protestant denominations that do and connect the return of the Jews to the Holy Land with the second coming of Christ. Although I have to point out that is not the Catholic Church's position at all.
All right.
So the question, how does modern Zionism connect to the Old Testament? Well, it connects historically in the sense that many of the proponents of Zionism seek to make arguments grounded in Old Testament prophecy and law and narrative. But from the point of view of the Catholic Church, there is no connection, right? And the modern state of Israel should be regarded the way we would regard any modern state, whether that be Israel or France or the Soviet, well, there's no Soviet Union, excuse me, Russia. It shows my Cold War heritage going on still. I was born in 1970. China or what have you, right?
Yeah.
And so the nation should be judged and evaluated by the kind of the standard norms of equity and justice that would apply to any civilization.
Anthony, is that helpful for you?
Yeah, I was just wondering, what does that put the Palestinians today in the scheme of all things? I mean, does God hate the Palestinians? Or because
oh, no, Jesus Christ died out of love for the Palestinians. And Jesus Christ has taught emphatically that if I want to go to heaven, I must love Palestinians and non-Palestinians and Israelis and Americans and Chinese people and Russians and South Africans and everybody, and especially if somebody holds themselves out to be my personal enemy, then I am under a special obligation to love them. And so Christ absolutely loves the Palestinian people as he loves all people. And our objective, our goal as Catholic people towards these individuals, as well as everybody on the earth, is to wish them flourishing and justice and a good life.
Anthony, thanks so much for your call from Arizona. Call to Communion here on EWTN. We got a text from Teo in Houston. The question is, can you cite a great example where we Catholics rely on tradition as it is not in the Scriptures? Thanks.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. The table of contents of the Bible. Right. The Bible does not delineate its own table of contents. It doesn't tell us which books belong in the Bible. The only way you can know which books belong in the Bible is by adverting to Catholic tradition. There is no other way. That's the only way you know. All right. And I could give a lot of other examples, but that's a pretty darn good one.
Sure is. Appreciate that. Thanks so much for your text. Here is Katie now. Katie's a first-time caller from East Texas, listening to us on Sirius XM Channel 130. Hey, Katie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Dr. Anders. Thank you for taking my call. Actually, it's my first time. I've always wanted to call, but I know it's for non-Catholics normally. I just have this question that hit me, and as soon as I got in the car and I started hearing somebody talking about something similar, I thought I just need some clarification. This past week, I read at church, and I've known my priest for over 5 years, and the conversations we've had have been about, you know, different people that have influenced me in my life, his life, and that sort of thing. One of the first conversations was about holy people. And I said to him, I said, we have been blessed, very blessed at this church with many holy priests in our time. And we've had these conversations. I talked about Mother Teresa and her holiness and the, you know, just intrinsic holiness of certain, like John Paul, and how wonderful it felt to walk the earth at the same time. Well, this past week, he stared right at me, and he said, do you believe, he said this during his homily, do you believe that there are holy people here on earth? And I nodded my head, and he looked around, and he said, there are not. Holy people are holy when they're in front of God and not before. There are no holy people here. And I was blown away. I don't know if something like hit him in the head, or maybe everything I thought is wrong.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So I have to say that your pastor is in error. He is in error. And not a small error, but in fact is contradicting the settled dogmatic teaching of the church that's taught by the extraordinary as well as the ordinary magisterium, as well as by Jesus Christ himself and the apostles, going back 2,000 years, that the vocation of every Christian person is to the life of holiness, which is absolutely a possibility in this life. And in fact, no one gets to the presence of God. You don't become a canonized saint unless, in fact, you die in the perfection of holiness. And I'm sure you've heard touted over and over again the concept of the universal call to holiness that was at the heart of the vision of the Second Vatican Council in its dogmatic declaration on the church, Lumen Gentium, Chapter 5, is all about the universal call to holiness and to the life of perfection of the Father to which we are called. And so I believe your priest is very much in error. Now, I'm hopeful that he is in error ignorantly, and that he is not consciously denying a dogma of the faith, because that would be the sin of heresy. My guess is it's something like this. In his priestly experience, he has met a lot of people who claim to be holy. Oh, beware of those people who claim to be holy.
Well, yeah.
You know, and he's met a lot of people who aren't holy, and he hears everybody's confessions. You know, I remember one time my wife went to a priest, it was Father Lambert, and she said, you know, I get down by all these super Catholics, you know, the families that have the 15 kids, and everybody shows up perfectly coiffed for Mass, and there's not a hair out of place, and everything's going great. And he's like, ah, yes, but you don't hear their confessions.
Ah.
You know, I do. He says, you know, trust me, like, there's things going on that you don't know about.
Sure.
And so maybe the priest has had some of that. Like, empirically, he looks out on the life in front of him. He says, you know, I'm not seeing a whole lot of holiness in my congregation, and he wants to maybe disabuse people of their falsely self-inflated notions of their own importance, which would be that'd be a good thing to do, right? That's what Christ did. Maybe he wants to encourage people that feel like, you know, they keep falling and they can't get up, and they try and try and try, but never gets any better, and he doesn't want them to have false expectations, and maybe that would be kind of an attitude of compassion. But then the other possibility is, you know, well, maybe his church lacks those super holy people because he's not preaching super holiness.
Ooh.
Or maybe he's not modeling it, or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. I mean, but his vocation as a priest is precisely to bring people to holiness. A really good priest friend of mine from my own diocese was appointed pastor of a parish just several years ago, and he told me he showed up on day one, got in the pulpit, and he said, well, the bishop has sent me here to get you to heaven, and that's what I intend to do.
Love that.
You know, and this is a priest who understood his vocation,
yeah.
Right? You know, so we're going to, you know, St. Thomas tells us we should always form the most generous judgment of another person if they seem to be in error. And so we're gonna take the most generous judgment we can and assume that, you know, his heart's in the right place and he's trying to inculcate humility or whatever it might be. But there's definitely some error in the teaching there, because what he should say is, well, holiness is not easy. Holiness is difficult. You know, a lot of people who think they're holy and are not. But hey, at the end of the day, we're all called to holiness. Let me now teach you about the church's ascetical and spiritual theology and what is necessary to walk this arduous path to the attainment of holiness that few of us may actually reach, but to which we are all called.
Katie, we hope that's helpful for you. Thanks for your call from East Texas. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Let me tell you about one of our great weekend programs. It's called Women Made New, where author and speaker Kristalina Everett chats with her guests about the hard topics that women struggle with. She and her guests remind everybody it's never too late to start over. Women Made New is women helping women. Check it out Saturday, noon Eastern, on EWTN Radio, one of the great weekend programs we love to bring to you each and every week. Let's go now to Lawrence in Raleigh, North Carolina, listening on iHeartRadio. Hey, Lawrence, what's on your mind today, sir?
Yes, Mr. Anders. My question is about the gospel command to turn the other cheek. I have three questions. First one is it true that the conquest of Asia Minor and North Africa by the Islamic armies in the 7th and 8th centuries Was it due to these areas being pacifist as they adhere to the gospel command to turn the other cheek?
Second
question is, what would the David Andrews of today want the 12-year-old David Andrews to say or do if he's slapped by a bully in the schoolyard? The third is, it's related to that, and to add to the situation in the second question, in addition to slapping him, he also says, you can't hit me back. Remember, you're a Christian. So those are my questions. Thank you, sir.
All right.
Yeah, thank you very much. First of all, with respect to the conquest of Asia Minor and North Africa during the Muslim invasions, do I think that the fall of these Christian states was due to their pacifism? I do not think that is the case. I think it had more to do with overreach by the Byzantine emperors and the fact that Nicene Orthodoxy and Chalcedonian Orthodoxy was associated with the imperial power, and many of the religious minorities, the Christian minority groups that were maybe not Chalcedonian in their confession, resented imperial overreach. And so they, I think, falsely assumed that, well, maybe things will be better under the caliphate than they are under the Byzantine emperors. And, well, you know, they learned a thing or two, didn't they? But I don't think it had anything to do with pacifism per se, because pacifism as a Christian ideal really wasn't in evidence, right? That wasn't the reigning view of the church in those periods, right? What would I want 12-year-old me to do if a bully slapped me on the playground? And how would I want 12-year-old me to respond to the statement, you can't hit me back because you're supposed to be a pacifist? So, you know, I take the admonition of Christ to turn the other cheek, and to, if someone asks me to go with him 1 mile, to go with him two, and so forth. I take those in the same spirit in which I take other statements of Christ that I believe to be hyperbolic. For example, you know, no one can be my disciple unless he hates his mother and father. Well, I do not believe that Jesus wants me to literally hate my parents. I think Christ wants me to prefer the kingdom of God to blood loyalty, but I don't think he wants me to literally hate my parents. And the rest of the New Testament, of course, admonishes me to love my parents. I don't think that it is absolutely forbidden to take up arms. St. Paul teaches that the secular power bears the sword for the sake of the common good, right? Well, if it's not in the interest of the common good to bear swords, that sentence makes absolutely no sense, right? That the use of military or martial power does have a role to play in any civilization. And when it comes to personal individual ethics, I don't think that I am under an obligation, or 12-year-old me is under an obligation to needlessly make myself a doormat, right? And to sign up for injustice as if it were some intrinsic good to be sought for its own sake. On the contrary, I think you know, God desires that there be justice in the world. And so, you know, I would hope that 12-year-old me or one of my own children would have the kind of critical discernment, and this is very unlikely, of course, but that kind of critical discernment to grasp whether there is, like, serious danger to life and limb here, right? You know, it's one thing for somebody to be humiliated or to be insulted. It's another thing to be disfigured and to be marred and to be, you know, permanently injured, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I would not want my child or myself to stand there and let another person seriously injure him or me for no good reason other than the aggrandizement of the bully. I don't think that serves the interests of the bully. I don't think it's good for the bully, and I don't think it's good for the child, all right? I would not want my child to have an attitude of vengeance or pride. And, I mean, I wouldn't want him to, you know, necessarily go out and study the martial arts so he could pound all bullies into the dirt and knock their teeth out and, you know, make them humiliated. I wouldn't want to turn the tables necessarily. But I would be hopeful that 12-year-old me would have, if 12-year-old me was going to get the snot kicked out of him by anybody. Like, I didn't have the wherewithal to defend myself against bullies, but if I had, I would hope that I would have had the ability to use just enough sufficient force, proportionate force, to protect life and limb and to get out of there unscathed.
Well, Lawrence, thanks so much for checking in from Raleigh this afternoon. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN. Judy is listening in Connecticut on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey, Judy, what's on your mind today?
First, I just want to say I love your show, and thank you for everything that I learn, and also the banter that you two have often brings me joy, so thank you. And then I have a two-part question. I was recently watching a video where they talked about purgatory and St. Gertrude, and they talked about penances and that being able to do penance on earth that could possibly help you in purgatory. So I wanted to know what kind of penances, what that would look like. And then also, you can, I know you can offer up like pain and being sick for the souls in purgatory, but can you do penances for the people in purgatory also? Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. I really appreciate the question. So, in terms of what kind of penances could I do now to lessen my time in purgatory? So, you know, the penance I think should not be regarded as a kind of you know, it's not like the divine slot machine or the divine jukebox, you know, where you put in the coin, you know, you pull the lever and you get out a quantitative amount of time off of purgatory. I think that's that sort of mechanistic, magical view of the spiritual life is not helpful, right? Because it ends up, you know, instrumentalizing the good works that we do and really detaching them from the spirit of penance. You know, there's a difference between the sacrament of penance and the spirit of having a penitential attitude, the virtue of being a penitential person, right? And then, of course, again, there's a difference between having that spirit of contrition and penitence as a virtue and then, you know, trying to exercise it in a mechanical way in the kind of works that Jesus would criticize in the gospel. You know, you're tithing mint, dill, and cumin, so you think you're okay, but you're neglecting love and justice and mercy, right? So however we do penance, we need to think about it in terms of the, you know, not just performing a ritual action so much as the shaping of our personality, right? That we are acquiring greater humility, that we're experiencing deeper contrition, that we're turning our life around and living more and more in accord with the mind of Christ. That's the point of penance. If I sit there and say 10,000 rosaries, you know, and then, you know, my kid knocks on the door and I say, "Go away, don't bother me, I'm praying my rosary," right? Well, I'm defeating the point of the rosary at that point. It's not bringing me to charity and to patience and humility. Then it's not doing me any good. And it's not really functioning as a penance at the end of the day, right? And so the wonderful thing that St. Thérèse of Lisieux teaches us is that if you are looking for penances, they are all around you all the time, every day, right? So, example, I want to go in my room and pray my rosary, and my kid keeps scratching on the door and bothering me, right? Well, Teresa's little way would be, maybe I need to put aside my egotistical pursuit of my own devotional preferences and turn instead and deal with the annoyingness that's right in front of me that happens to wear a human face.
Yes.
But that was a Teresa's little way, is that the people in our lives and the duties of our state of life that we can find so troublesome and annoying, if we will reframe our relationship to them, we can see that these are plentiful opportunities to grow in virtue and to be the presence of Christ to other people, right? And so just embracing the duties of one's state of life with charity and humility and patience and servant-heartedness and putting the other person first. And if one is married, for example, marriage is a sacrament of service that is mirrored after the passion of Christ, that I die to myself, it's not about me, so I can put the needs of this community, of the family, ahead of my own and seek their welfare, right? If I'm doing those things, I'm probably constructing my heart and my life around the kind of penitential attitude that's going to do more to get me out of purgatory than any number of, you know, repetitive prayers that I pray. Now, I'm not knocking the repetitive prayers. We should do those too,
sure,
right? But they should serve the ends of holiness, right? They're not ends in themselves. They serve the ends of uniting us closer to Christ, closer to the Blessed Virgin, closer to the pattern of the holy life. When it comes to picking up our own private devotions, you know, you take the private devotion that you connect with the most. The church is filled with them. We got thousands of devotions. You can't possibly get to them all, right? And so you take the ones that are nearest and dearest to your heart. Now, for many people, particularly in the West, the rosary is one of their favorite devotions. And it's so useful. It's so tangible with the beads and the mysteries and the habit of the thing, and it has a definite starting point and a stopping point. It's been commended to us by many, many popes. You don't have to pray the rosary. You can do another devotion, but it's an awful good one. If you got to pick one, I'd say go for the rosary.
There you go. Judy, thanks for your call from Connecticut. Got a call today from Matt in Fargo. Unfortunately, Matt, we're all out of time. Please call us back tomorrow. We'll put you at the head of the line. Hey, Dr. David Anders, thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Tom.
Don't forget, we do it right here on EWTN Radio at 2 p.m. Eastern each and every Monday through Friday. Check out the podcast of today's program and all the other ones that you've been hearing on EWTN at EWTN's Podcast Central, EWTN.com/podcast. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow on the Thursday edition of Call to Communion. Have a wonderful, wonderful day, and God bless.